Right, this is quite exciting. This is the first of our regular podcasts. I say regular with a hint of exaggeration, I guess, because we haven't done one for a couple of months. But this is the first one we've done, which is international. Today, it's not just osteopaths in the UK. We're actually talking to John Smart. John Smart with two T's. That's a bit greedy, John, having two T's.
Oh, well, it's just weird.
John Smart is in Australia, and John is well known, I think, now throughout the LinkedIn network for having written a paper on hypothyroidism, particularly. John, this is a paper of yours about thyroid disorders. What's your background in this? How come you're expert in thyroid?
Well, probably not. I'm basically a hands-on osteopath, and I just picked up, as a lot of people have, I'm sure, information around the fact that thyroid wasn't normally very well dealt with by the medical profession. And I started looking into it and kept getting conflicting information and decided that I really should make time to look into it more thoroughly to find out what the truth of it was.
Did you get so taught much at college? Did you get taught what to do about thyroid problems when you were studying? I presume you studied in Australia.
I studied in Australia. We got taught it at a very superficial level, which I think is the same level that, certainly in Australia, the medical profession gets taught. So what you're taught basically is that thyroid is a hormone that increases the metabolic rate, and that there's a feedback loop. If you have too much thyroid hormone produced by your thyroid gland, then it stimulates the pituitary gland to put out thyroid or to release its reduced amount of thyroid stimulating hormone, so you produce less thyroid. So you've got this inbuilt feedback mechanism, and but it can affect a lot of systems, and that's kind of what we learned. So,
but there's only two solutions, aren't there? If it produces too much, you chop it out, and if it doesn't produce enough, you give people thyroxine.
That's pretty much right. If there's too much, first of all, they give people drugs to slow it down, and then they chop it out. But that's pretty much right. It tends to be done very simplistically, and the thing is, what they normally measure is either just thyroid-stimulating hormone, the one that goes from the pituitary to the thyroid gland, or thyroxine, T4, because that's a nice stable hormone in the system. But that's really looking at the topic of a chemical cascade, and there's a lot of things can go wrong with it. And in fact, it's debatable whether T4 thyroxine is technically a hormone at all. It's actually more a pre-hormone. It's a precursor to more active form, and so just measuring that is in no way adequate. So what I was seeing, as I'm sure most hands-on therapists are, is a lot of people come through the door who were in more pain than they should have been, who were a little bit depressed or sometimes very depressed, but they may not have presented with depression, but if you ask them when was the last time they heard the music of life, they go, oh yeah, I don't remember. They find it hard to get going in the morning. Everything hurts more than it should. They have a range of symptoms. They may have menstrual irregularities. They may tell you that they've got osteoporosis because the doctor's told them. They may tell you that they're constipated and they're sluggish. They've got sluggish digestion. And in fact, if they're older patients, that's most of the people you see.
Yeah. So why do they feel pain more than they should for a given given problem?
I think there's two reasons. One is that when the thyroid mechanism is operating slowly, the lymphatic system operates slowly. When the lymphatic system operates slowly, then fluid builds up in the lymphatic tissues, and the lymphatic tissues have stretch receptors in them. So they start to get sore. So any pressure, or even without pressure, on the lymphatics hurts more than it otherwise would. The other thing with the lymphatics is when they're going slowly, they aren't as efficient at draining out inflammatory chemicals from any area that's inflamed or sore. So pain lasts longer. It's more intense than it would otherwise be. The other thing around it is that people with a thyroid problem tend to be at least a little depressed, and there's fairly good evidence showing that people who are more depressed feel physical pain or more aware of physical pain. So for that reason, I think there's a lot of people with this problem anyway, but I think in manual therapy we see a disproportionate amount. Another thing that happens is they know they're not well, so they tend to do the round of practitioners. And when they do the round of practitioners, they come seeing us. And when they see us, we can make them feel better for a while, so we like to see them quite a bit because we'll make them feel better for a while, but because we're not if we don't deal with this thyroid problem, we're not dealing with the underlying issue. So they keep coming back, and very often with similar but related complaints. These people are typically very hard to get well for a long time. They get helped in some ways.
So what made you feel in the initial stages that as a manual therapist you could do something for this? Because it's not the obvious solution to the problem, is it?
Well, actually, I didn't want to. I have my head's far too many full of many other things. And what I started doing was referring people off to other people, to naturopaths, to integrative doctors. But what I found, at least where I am, is that an awful lot of them were coming back no better, and they'd tell me about the supplements that they were put on, and I'd then be asking, from the very little I knew, well, did they test for this, did they test for that? And they'd be saying, no, they just gave me the supplement. And so somewhat reluctantly, I'm fascinated by it now, but at the start I was really reluctant to delve into it because I just knew it was a huge area and my brain was already full. But the sort of thing that happens that I've now learned is that with iodine, for instance, normal thyroid supplements include iodine, and if you're iodine deficient, that's a wonderful thing. But if you have high iodine to start with, iodine actually makes a thyroid problem worse. That's so much so that they used to give iodine to people as the standard of treatment of choice for people who had too much thyroid hormone.
Didn't you say in your paper that there's actually a response to an overload of iodine, which actually is to shut down the TSH generation?
That's exactly right. So the idea of just giving people iodine because their thyroid is slow without checking their iodine, I consider to be quite dangerous. And this is the sort of thing that was happening to my patients. And I thought, but I didn't understand it well. I just had snippets of information.
I think that's probably very common with nutritional therapy, with the approach to thyroid problems, isn't it? His first port of call is chucking loads of iodine.
I think that's exactly right. Another one is selenium, and the thing is the same. Selenium's really good in some circumstances, but if selenium's already high and they increase the selenium dose, that actually makes the thyroid worse. So it's critically important to actually measure levels of these things. You can't assess them clinically. I don't believe you can assess them clinically because you get exactly the same symptoms with low iodine as you do with high iodine. You do get the same symptoms with low selenium as high selenium. So it really becomes quite important to measure and assess. And this wasn't happening, or not, as people do.
This is perhaps jumping ahead a little bit, but what do you recommend to other therapists if we want to suggest our patients get measured, get a good assessment as to how much iodine they've got, whether they're deficient in selenium? What do you recommend to patients, or would that be different in Australia to here?
Well, it will be different laboratories, and it depends to some extent on the symptoms, but a fairly good thing to do to start off with is a test of their iodine, which is a urine test. Iodine deficiency is chronic and it's getting worse. Iodine was about the first trace element ever discovered, and at least in Australia, if you live in Australia and you have an iodine deficiency until proven otherwise, so much so that before I was born, they started iodising the salts. I don't know if that's the same in England, but one of the standard salts we can get is iodised salt.
I thought it was, yeah. But I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't tend to eat much salt, so I haven't really noticed anything on the packets, but I should check.
Well, that's the thing. There's two things that have happened in Australia, at least. One is that people are eating less salt, that could be a whole other webinar whether that's good advice, but they're eating less salt, but the other thing is they're tending to eat more gourmet salts, which aren't iodized.
Yeah.
And so the effect is that we've got iodine deficiencies happening all over the place, so much so that it's been in the press that it's been causing birth defects with iodine deficiency.
Right.
And so it's a fairly obvious thing to do to start with if someone has thyroid symptoms, to test their iodine levels. At least in Australia, it's cheap. It's a $60 test. Send it off to the lab. And it's, you know, there's debates about how accurate the test is, but it seems to be good enough to give you a ballpark.
Is that $60? Is that the urine test or the hair analysis test?
That's the urine test.
Right, okay. Because you also talked about hair analysis and you talked about the varying quality of different labs for that test.
Yes. So the another test I do a lot of is hair mineral analysis. And unfortunately, that won't pick up iodine. It won't pick up halogens like iodine, fluoride and chlorine, unfortunately, which they may well be relevant to thyroid. But they pick up most other minerals. So it picks up... That will pick up some of the cofactors that are important for the conversion of T4, what's normally called thyroid hormone, to the active form T3, and that includes zinc, selenium, copper, probably manganese. And it also gives a fair indication of whether there's a thyroid problem, because when there's a thyroid problem, calcium levels tends to go high in relation to phosphorus and in relation to potassium. So because of those, we'll also show you some of the heavy metals that can interfere with a thyroid mechanism, like mercury and cadmium. So I find that a really good test to get at some of the underlying nutritional elements. I also like to refer people for blood tests, and it took me quite a while to find a lab that will do these. They're not standard laboratory tests, but tests that we'll look at, as well as thyroxine and thyroid-stimulating hormone, that we'll look at T3, which is the active form, and free T3, because you can have lots of T3, which is still bound to a protein, but for a number of reasons, it's not free T3. They'll look at thyroid autoantibodies, and they'll look at a thing called reverse T3, which is something the body produces after a significant period of stress that the body uses to slow people down, which is one of the
common... There's a lot of complicating factors in this, aren't there? Because, first of all, there's a hell of a lot of things to look for, some of which may or may not be indicative of a thyroid problem. But also, I suspect that in this country, very, very few osteopaths are equipped to do those tests, which means that they would have to refer back to a GP. And again, I'm guessing here, but I'm guessing that most GPs are not going to be very sympathetic to an osteopath saying, I want to test this person for thyroid problems, because what it sounds like from your perspective is that virtually everybody should be tested because it's so common.
Yes to all of those things. So it's been a journey of exploration for me, a journey to find the right labs, and... a huge learning curve to try and come to terms with is testing things. My approach was basically to try things out on myself, read up on them. If it seemed to be a useful test, try it out on my family. If it seemed to be a useful test, try it out on my patients. And very much started with each patient saying, look, this isn't my area. I don't know anything about this. But if they're not being tested for you, this, I think you should try that. I'm more confident with it now, but certainly I started off really erring on the side of not wanting patients to think that I knew more than I knew about things.
So do you do you send patients the labs that you send the patients to, these are private labs rather than going through the GP?
That's correct. Yes. What I'm much more likely to do now is do my own testing and then send... if the person needs a lot of supplementation, I would still rather someone else who is more qualified recommended those. But I do the testing first of all, tell them what I think, and get them to either organise their own supplements or take their reports to whoever else they're seeing, because I just found that it wasn't being done and wasn't being adequately understood if I didn't do that.
So walk us through what happens when you're assessing someone in clinic. There's a big long list of potential signs and symptoms that you talked us through earlier on. What are the clues that are going to make you think you need to get someone tested?
Well, it's really... I'll read from the paper now, because it's such a common list of things. Tiredness is a big one, and particularly finding it hard to get going in the morning and only wake in the evening. Mood swings, irritability, particularly when it surprises them, depression, abnormal tenderness, muscles which are tight, difficulty losing weight, easy bruising, swelling at the base of the neck, headaches, irregular menstrual cycle, diminished libido in either sex, diminished fertility in either sex, partial or complete impotence in men, multiple miscarriages, tender non-cancerous lumps in the breast, frontal alopecia or hair loss, decreased vision at night, numbness or tingling in the extremities, mild hearing loss, thinning of the outer third of the eyebrows, cold hands or feet, dry skin, fluid retention, constipation, or an irritable bowel, mild proteinuria. Sometimes they come and tell me that they've found that. Change in the normal rhythm of urine production, mild or borderline anemia, forgetting things or the brain seems foggy, something I hear a lot of in clinic. People come in and say, my brain just feels foggy. Dementia in the elderly, just feeling unwell or can't put their finger on why, feeling of being unable to cope, calcification of the blood vessels or connective tissues, high cholesterol, that's such a significant one, or people may tell you that they're on cholesterol medication. In fact, as an aside, cholesterol used to be the main test of thyroid before they got better tests. That's so closely linked to thyroid conditions. High triglycerides or low bone mineral density. So if anyone comes to me with a few of those things, my standard thing is then to take their temperature in clinic with an oral mercury thermometer.
I'm just thinking it's hard to find a patient who hasn't got any of those things.
That's exactly right. I just think this is incredibly common. The thing you have to be careful of course is there's a lot of causes of any one of those things, so just because someone has those things it doesn't mean they have a thyroid problem, but it immediately says to me that I need to include that on my differential diagnosis. So that would probably be more than half the patients, in fact. I'd need to include this as part of what I'm thinking about. And so my next step is to take their temperature. If their temperature when they're in clinic is, and so I use an oral mercury thermometer, I put it under the tongue for 2 minutes. If it's below 36.5 degrees Celsius, do you use Celsius in England or?
Yeah, we do.
If it's below 36.5 degrees Celsius, then until proven otherwise, I assume it's a thyroid problem. If it's above 36.5 and they still have those symptoms, then it may or may not be. What I then encourage them to do is take their temperature themselves first thing in the morning before they've done anything to raise their core temperatures, so before they've eaten, drunk, showered, exercised.
Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that, John, does the female cycle have a role to play in that? Does that affect the temperature that you're seeing first thing in the morning, or is that kind of irrelevant?
No, it does affect it. I think it's when the progesterone kicks in, the temperature drops from memory. I may stand corrected on that. It either drops or climbs. I don't think it's enough to make this difference, but certainly some practitioners recommend people do this for a whole month. Mm-hmm. But normally when there's a problem, there's it's sort of more obvious than that. So having done that, I describe it to patients like a treasure hunt. It can be a very frustrating exercise for the patient, because what they want is the one person to tell them exactly what's wrong and to give them the one tablet, and it's rarely like that. Normally it's a whole investigation. You may do some patients who are feeling financial, because unfortunately they don't get any of this testing back from their insurance company or the government. Some of them want to do everything at once. Most want to just do one test. And then depending on what the results of that, they may be willing to do another one and another one. It might take quite a series of tests to narrow down what the problem is. But depending on what happens would then, and how they feel about things, would then decide on what test I use. So, for example, if their temperature is fluctuating, I tend to go for an iodine test first, because when iodine is low, we've talked about the active form of thyroid before, which is T3. It means it's lost a molecule of iodine. So you need less iodine for T3 than you do for T4. And one of the ways the body compensates for not having enough iodine is to make more of the active form, but the active form's unstable, which is what normally stays in your body in the inactive form.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Or not so much unstable, the active form gets used up. So a low iodine level can make a temperature fluctuate quite a bit. So if the temperature's fluctuating, because it's the cheapest test, I'll quite often give people an iodine. If people have other indications that would suggest the possibility of heavy metal contamination, which is very common, or other reasons that make me think of that a hair mineral analysis is the right way to go, and that could be anything from stretch marks in the skin indicates possible zinc deficiency, possibly a number of other things. It could be that they complain of headaches with bright lights, which can mean an irritated optic nerve, which can mean an inflamed system. If they tell me they're gluten intolerant, there's a whole lot of things that would then suggest we do a hair mineral analysis. Or in other cases, particularly, for example, if they tell me that they, which is a very common thing, that they've come through a long period of stress and now they're exhausted, I'd be more inclined to go for the blood test. In that instance, I'm particularly thinking about their reverse T3 levels. So one of the common, one of the very common scenarios I see, and I would imagine most people listening to this would see, is people who go through a period of long, horrible stress, perhaps looking after someone who's dying, perhaps a divorce, perhaps a combination of those things, and the stress passes and they start to feel better, and then they feel physically exhausted. And it's incredibly frustrating because for them, because they've just been through this and they expect to be able to get on with their life now, and suddenly they're tired, whereas they weren't tired when they were in the middle of the stress. And what is mostly happening there is the body produces a thing called reverse T3 in relation to the elevated levels of cortisol that the stress has caused, which I think is simply the body forcing them to go into a period of being slow in recovery while they recover. And once people understand this, that this is what's happening, it's much easier for them to cope and to realise that they just need to recover, whereas otherwise it's incredibly frustrating because they just now they want to get on with their lives and their system won't let them. And I think very often what happens is the people who try to push through that period where their body's trying to slow them down and try to get their energy up and keep up their normal level of activities, they're the people whose immune system ends up packing it in, and they can wind up in a sort of chronic fatigue state. So I think it's really important for people to understand that their body just wants them to slow down.
There's some real crossover here, isn't there, with heart disease, because you talked earlier on about cholesterol levels, and I'm not one of those who believes that raised cholesterol causes heart disease. And you touched on that because cholesterol, you said originally, was an indicator of thyroid problems, but it was a result of the thyroid problem. And there is a theory, contrary to what most people believe, that actually raised cholesterol is a result of a heart problem, but not the heart problem directly. It's the result of raised stress levels in the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, again because of the elevation of cortisol levels, which produces that. So you know, actually, there's some real crossover between the two here, in that stress could be a major component in, surprise, surprise, an awful lot of disease.
Look, that's absolutely right. There's a massive crossover in all endocrine conditions. It's at the end of my paper, I show a diagram of incredible spider work of crossover between hormones.
I tried to read your diagram. It was, of course, on the A4 paper, it's unreadable, but you did say that you can make available at a scale that we can see. Could we, I asked you this earlier, do you mind if we make your paper available through the website, provided we keep track of who's got it so that we can update them when it's altered?
No, I'd be delighted for that to happen. I just think it's very important for the word about this to get out, because there's so many people who are really suffering in so many different ways, and simply through a lack of good information and lack of good diagnosis about their health conditions.
And I have to admit that when I looked at your LinkedIn posts and I saw thyroid, I thought, oh no, I don't want to read about thyroid. But I looked through your paper and it is absolutely fascinating. And what's more, the great thing about it is it's directly relevant to what we can do as physical therapists. It's not simply a case of refer to the doctor and let them chop it out or give you thyroxine.
Look, that's absolutely right. In terms of the on the physical treatment of the thyroid gland itself, I think that there's things that can be done. There's certainly people got back to me and said, the paper hasn't said enough about physically treating the thyroid, and generally people talk about treating a number of structures that can impact on the thyroid, the lymphatics around it, the the mechanisms of the tongue, the nerve supply to the thyroid, some of the connective tissues. When I got back to people and said, can you give me specific cases where you've even measured a core temperature before and after, no one's been able to. Mm. But if anyone can, if anyone's listening to this and they have an actual case study of where that's worked, I'd love that to be the case. What I think it probably happens is where there's diminished blood supply to the thyroid, which can certainly happen. It's a very thirsty thing. It needs more blood than the kidneys. Or when there's diminished lymphatic drainage, inflammation can be worse. So I suspect that by manually treating the thyroid, we can diminish the inflammation. And we certainly tend to find that with other tissues, so I don't know why we wouldn't with the thyroid. We can treat other tissues, we can generally diminish inflammation. But I suspect that it's an area which is so vulnerable to other biochemical influences, and particularly for just nutritional imbalances, which you can't sort out manually, that it really needs a combination approach to...
Possibly I was being a bit misleading there. I didn't mean that necessarily by direct physical intervention we could treat it, but there is something that can be done other than the conventional medical approach, which, you know, the complementary realm has a role to play in.
Absolutely, I think. I think we spend far more time with people than normal medicine does, and I think we tend to diagnose more thoroughly. And to me, by moving into the biochemical realm of being even more diagnostic, that's very complementary with what we do, just really taking a thorough look at not just what's happening, but why is it happening, which is what I think, you know, distinguishes
in some way. It's interesting, isn't it? We, just by complete coincidence, we had a bit of conversation earlier on today about a completely different topic, of broken legs, and the fact that we can be treating all of these things, but we need to also bear in mind that our expectations with the treatment have to be, maybe realistic's the wrong word, but at least considered, and not necessarily to expect miracles. If we're working on the thyroid or on a leg that's severely broken, maybe our approach is that we ask the body for change, but also understand that this might be beyond what osteopathy can help with, and nutrition or medical intervention might actually be able to help more than us.
I'm sure that's absolutely right. I think the issue is that we're dealing with something very complex. Mm. And we're dealing with the human body. We're dealing with something very complex, full stop. And the more we think we understand something, we just get right to the end of it and then find that the little bit that we thought we didn't understand is 10 times more complex than we thought. The more we delve into it, the more complex we see it is.
Is there much research going on into this, do you think?
Sorry?
Is there much research going on into this, do you think?
Into the thyroid?
Yeah.
It's just massive. It's not being pulled together, but it's massive. I was saying earlier, when I attempted to update the thyroid paper, I did a Medline search just with the words thyroid or thyroxin in the title or abstract, just published, new articles published since the 1st of May 2014, of 4,600 new articles.
Yeah.
So it's just enormous, the research. But, of course, the research is moving faster and faster than the textbooks can keep up with it, which is where the problem lies. I realised when I was researching my paper that the things that I was taught at university 15 years ago were out of date then. They were about 15 years out of date then. And so it's enormously challenging to keep up in any field, I think, and becoming more so. So one of the responses is to get more and more specialisation. But I think for a profession that wants to treat people holistically, that isn't always an option, because in getting back to your point, Claire, about not always knowing not always being able to predict the result. I think the issue is we're willing to engage with complexity because we're willing to ask why.
Yeah.
And so we're not just asking for what is the problem and what is the treatment of choice, move on to the next patient. We're going, what is the problem? Why did that happen? Okay, that happened. Why did that happen? Why did that happen? And very soon you're into a whole complex area, and very soon the knowledge explodes on you. So just with the thyroid, we've started doing something I find really promising, or I hope it's as promising as it appears to be, because updating this paper was completely beyond me with 4,600 new papers in the last 7 months. I put out a call to people who'd received it, and that's down to about 480 people. And you know, quite a number of people got back to me volunteering to help with the research. And I hope that this works, and I think if we can have a cooperative research effort into all sorts of things, that could be very, very exciting, because I can't see how else we can keep up.
Well, we will put the word out on our site. We'll ask for people to help, and people listening to this will hopefully want to engage with that. We will, whenever you're able to provide any updates to the paper, obviously we will make sure that those people who have downloaded the paper get those updates, and hopefully they'll share it with everyone else with whom they've shared the paper itself. John, it really has been fascinating, and I don't want to take too much more of your time, because I suspect that you've got a busy day of you ahead of you, it being, 8 in the morning there at the moment, or 7 in the morning?
It's 7:30 in the morning here now.
Yeah, right. It's been a treat talking to you. This is really fascinating stuff, and I'm sure you'll be hearing more from people over here about how we can engage with you and with dealing with the thyroid. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much, and I think what you're doing with these webinars is fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you.
Osteoblast.